Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, and we are transmitting across the internet. This is episode 68 of Registry Matters. Larry, happy Saturday night. How are you?
Saturday night?
Isn't it? Do I have the days right?
Well, it is Saturday, but I don't think it's past 6 p.m. yet in your time zone, so it's not night. It's still afternoon, isn't it?
It is past 6 p.m. in my time zone. We are recording, like, technically an hour sooner than we would be normally because of that stupid thing where we push the clock forward. So we're actually an hour ahead of where we would be as the Earth rotates, you know, where the sun would be if we use sundials for time.
We are, and I remember pontificating last episode about the various pieces of legislation about changing the time.
Right. And so back in the day, what was it like when you used a sundial and that was the only way that you could tell time? What'd you do when it was cloudy?
Now I only go back to the Lincoln era. So I'm not sure how they did it beyond that, but we did look up at the sun and try to judge the time of the day because not everybody could afford pocket watches were expensive back in that day. They didn't have wristwatches much in Lincoln's era, so you'd carry a big pocket watch, and they were expensive. People who could not afford those, we relied on the sun in those days to get an idea of what time it was.
Absolutely. This probably would also be where, like, the reason for the time change stuff is for farming, as far as my understanding of the origination goes, so that the kids weren't out doing their farming chores at, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning where it's pitch black, but so that it was closer to where the sun would be coming up. That's my understanding of the origination of it.
I think that farming and also it was a wartime. They did that in World War I. They changed temporarily to, I think, maybe been doing it off and on, but then it became a regular fixture in 1966 with the Uniform Time Standards Act.
Ooh. Uniform Time Standards Act, eh?
That's what I recall. And then in 1973, we did the emergency daylight saving time because of the energy embargo. And then within a year or so, we repealed that because of all the children struck by vehicles. And that's what we talked about last week. What has changed since 73? No one's told me what has changed in terms of that.
No doubt. I am going to spring a... I'm going to spring a voicemail message to you. Okay. I forgot that this one was in here and I didn't prep you for it, but I think you'll be okay. Are you ready for it?
I'll do my best. I love phone calls. Is this one real?
Yeah, this, the other one was real too, Larry.
All right.
What are you talking about?
I thought that other one sounded a little fishy last week, but I tried to answer.
No. I totally wouldn't troll you, man. All right. So here's a voicemail message.
This is Will from Tennessee, and I have a question for Larry. When I listen to the podcast and you're talking about court rulings, I hear you always specify those who have paid their debt to society, meaning that they are no longer either incarcerated and they're no longer under any type of supervision. And in Tennessee, the way our community supervision law works is at the end of 15 calendar years, a registrant who is on supervision can petition the sentencing court to be released from supervision. However, it is clearly written in the statute that the court does not have an automatic obligation to let you go just because you've served the 15 years. And if you are turned down, you have to wait 3 more years to renew your petition. And I could see that being denied indefinitely every time until an offender either can't come to court anymore or until the offender has drawn his last breath. And I was wondering, is there any way to challenge laws that abridge our rights with no guaranteed end in sight? And thank you for all you do, and have a great evening, and keep up the good work. Take care.
Now, he told me he had a philosophical problem with saying FYP at the end, so I still let the voicemail run, even though that didn't have it at the end of it.
All right. Well, I like I like there's a whole, we could do the whole podcast here. Do you want to spend the whole evening on this?
Run it. Let's go. We'll just scrap all the articles that we have.
Well, he's described punishment succinctly with one exception. He talked about the incarceration component, if there is any, and any post-incarceration probation or parole supervision. And then there would also be, when I say paying your debt, I mean when you serve the entire sentence imposed by the court, which hypothetically a court could say that upon release from prison, the person will have 10 years probation, 5 to be supervised and 5 to be unsupervised. Don't hear that much with sex offenses, but it would be when the entire sentence had been served, regardless of what type of confinement it was. What he gets into is a little bit more dicey in the states that have community supervision for life, because I'm not as versed on that as I should be. My understanding may be wrong, but I think they've actually retroactively applied that to people and saying it's not really punishment. It's a regulatory scheme similar to registration. So if I'm right about that, then the answer would be the challenge would be stronger, because to report to a probation supervising type of officer with conditions and restraints upon your liberty after you had served what was your sentence, if that CSL, as they generally refer to it, was imposed retroactively, you'd have a very compelling case. If the CSL only applied to people who committed their sexual offense after CSL was passed, then theoretically, the punishment is within the sound purview of the legislators and the executive branch to come to an agreement with input from the people. And you could put forth a theory that supervision for life is violative of the Constitution. But I think long-term podcast listeners have heard me say that that's a tough thing to prove, because the courts are looking at, we've got these literalists who believe in interpreting the words exactly what they would have meant at the time. And cruel and unusual, what was considered cruel and unusual back in colonial times, it would be hard to imagine that supervision reporting to an officer periodically would be presumed cruel and unusual, because in colonial times, they didn't consider the death penalty to be cruel, nor was it unusual. They used it quite readily and still do. 30-some-odd states still do have the death penalty on the books. So if putting you to death is not cruel, it's difficult for me to imagine if you are interpreting with looking at the prism of what the words meant in colonial times with all that mumbo jumbo of evolving standards of decency that the liberals buy into, then you would not be able to come to that conclusion. But it would be a viable challenge, I would think, to bring forth such a challenge, particularly for those who had that imposed on them after the fact, and then even those who it was imposed on prospectively, that meaning that after they passed the law that it applied to people who committed sexual offenses after that, a punishment that never ends seems to be within a zone of what we didn't. I would make the argument that the founders didn't intend on punishment to go on perpetually. That if we're going to look at the way the founding fathers were thinking, they weren't planning on. I mean, the only way that it would end would be perpetual, I guess, when you went into the ground if they executed you. But otherwise, punishments were actually very brief in colonial times. You didn't. Right. We didn't have long sentences in those days. They didn't have the money. They didn't have the facilities. They didn't lock people up for long periods of time.
Yeah, they punished the shit out of you, but it was not for a terribly long time.
Well, and then they didn't have probation. Is really kind of a modern era thing that's come about in the last 100 years. We didn't, but that's not all that modern. But in colonial times, there was really a little. If you do the history of probation, it's a relatively modern phenomenon. I think the U.S. Bureau of Probation Services probably has been around for less than 100 years. If you Google it, it's probably been something created in the 30s or 40s, maybe.
So Will then goes out and finds an attorney to try and to make a legit challenge. He would have to – could he challenge it before he fits into that zone of like post-sentence, before like termination and all that stuff, if he's just under the lifetime supervision statute?
Well, if it was applied to him after he committed his offense, I'd say he doesn't need to wait, that he should be talking to attorneys now. Of course, they're going to have their paws out saying that this is going to be a monumental challenge and we're going to need to get paid. And he's going to say, I don't have any money, which is always the inhibitor. And But if it was imposed on him afterwards, I don't still don't know why he would have to wait 15 years. Because if he's going to make any type of challenge, I don't think he has to wait 15 years to get off. Because I wouldn't say just because they didn't let me off that makes it unconstitutional. I mean, that might add some fuel to the fire, but if it's unconstitutional, you wouldn't have to wait 15 years to get relief from an unconstitutional law. That would be kind of silly, don't you think?
Right. And do you understand? Like, I'm trying to make sure that I'm clear on the question that I'm asking, in that is, where he has standing skin in the game is, you know, is he in the zone of him making this challenge, I guess? Like the Packingham people, they're post-sentence, but they still couldn't go use social media. They are being affected by that at that time.
Well, I clearly, you know, this is not a legal opinion, but as a lay opinion,
no, I know.
Clearly think he's within the zone. If law applies to him, I clearly think he can challenge it. He's within the zone of enforcement, and you don't even have to be within the zone of enforcement. In some situations, you have to be within a zone of potential enforcement, even if they're not enforcing it on you yet.
Coming up next year, or, you know, whatever, sometime in the semi-near future that it's going to apply to you, you could start challenging.
Well, if they were to pass a law that would, for it, say it was going to take effect in 6 months, well, it's not hurting you yet.
Right.
But you don't have to wait the entire 6 months if you fit within the zone of what it's going to, who it's going to apply to. You don't have to wait till you're being harmed. If the governor signed it and it's going to take effect, you're within a zone of enforceability. Unless the prosecutor... Sure. The chief prosecutor of that jurisdiction says, we are not going to ever enforce this law. We believe it's unconstitutional, which once in a great while happens, you've got standing. So if they impose this on him retroactively, he's got obvious standing. If they imposed it, if his crime occurred after they created CSL, Community Supervision for Life, he can still say that a lifetime punishment is unconstitutional. I don't know that he would have to wait the 15 years to see if he gets off, because if it's unconstitutional, it's unconstitutional. It wouldn't magically become unconstitutional after 15 years.
That makes sense. Well, cool. Well, thank you, Will. I think that was a good question. Larry liked it, at least. I'm not qualified to tell you whether it was a good question or not, but Larry says it was good.
Well, his questions are always good. We just never have good answers. Because everything is always around money, which we don't have enough of in this movement. And I think Tennessee has the potential to do a lot more litigating because they fall within that Sixth Circuit. And if I'm not mistaken, let me double check that so I don't misspeak, but I think they're in that Sixth Circuit. And they
I believe so.
They've got some good case law. They've got some good case law out of the Sixth Circuit.
Yeah. Kentucky, also Ohio, I think.
So,
I think Ohio's in there too.
So what else are we doing tonight?
Yep, well,
Tennessee,
I was going to
Eastern District of Tennessee, Middle District of Tennessee. So maybe not the entire state of Tennessee, but it says Eastern District and Middle District. Let me see if it says the other, because I need to click on more items. So, and the Western District, the entire state.
Well, you know, there was something that someone brought it to my attention directly over Twitter. The person's handle on Twitter is NHCCJR, which I'm going to assume is New Hampshire. I don't know what the first C would be, but then criminal justice reform is going to be the handle. And asked a question. I only saw that this was on Facebook, but you said it lit up all kinds of different channels, talking about a policy in this town of Foxborough, Massachusetts, where the way that it was presented to me, and like my little short overview read, was that the town, if you get accused of something, like, it's almost as if you've been convicted of the thing. That's how it was presented to me, and that's how I felt it was. But you have a slightly different take on it, and I shouldn't say slightly. I'm saying that sarcastically. You have a pretty radically different opinion of what's going on here.
Well, it is according to the population of a small town. I think isn't the Patriots football team, don't they have some connection to Foxborough?
I think good that's grief. I don't know. You start talking, I'll look up Foxborough and find out if that's where the Patriots are from. Yeah.
But yeah, it's in Texas. I mean, hey, excuse me. That's a
in where?
Texas.
It's a population of 16,000 people.
Well, it's a proposed policy for the town. And I'm not endorsing the policy, so the hate mail won't be necessary. I'm not endorsing the policy. But it's a policy which seems to offer potential for those who say how much they believe in prevention. Because although I can see problems with the policy, with the initial language that's being proposed, that's the whole reason why you have a legislative process, and that's the reason why you have public comment, and that's the reason why things get drafted and redrafted multiple times. It would behoove those who are big believers in prevention, because this is apparently aimed at targeting behavior that might be construed as grooming and in preparation for a sexual offense with an adolescent, that they would want to intervene in advance. Well, now, I wouldn't want, looking at that proposed policy, I would not want them curtailing a person's access to whatever facilities in the town that they're allowed to be in, which it looks like that's what they're proposing. But on the other hand, I don't know, if I were a proponent of prevention, that I would not be in favor of offering that person counseling. It seems like that would be exactly what we could agree on, is that, well, if there's credible evidence that a person is escalating towards possibly committing a crime, and you can figure out a way to divert that behavior, that seems to be what prevention is all about.
It does seem fair. But isn't this taking away someone's due process?
Well, I don't. Well, the way the thing is worked, there were some due process in there. I'm like I said, I'm not advocating approval of this particular wording, but it does invite a dialogue, which I haven't heard anyone when all the chatter's been going on for the last couple of weeks, I haven't heard anyone say, well, gee, I'm not really excited about some of what the language is, but I think this is worthy of getting involved in talking to these people to see if we can come up with some constitutional language. And we would rather than having it so heavily weighted in favor of law enforcement, we would possibly want to divert some of the law enforcement money into treatment.
Right.
If I mean, I've heard Todd Blue in the face about people ought to be offered treatment. Haven't you?
Yes. Diversion from prison and get them some sort of counseling treatment, whatever.
Well, okay. Well, here's an opportunity to have that discussion. Say, you people say you're all for treatment and take this to the town, because this is supposedly a progressive town in the progressive northeastern part of the country where they would be more inclined to do treatment, and say, well, let's be careful. We're not going to violate the Constitution here, because we can't really contain people. There's really very few lawful mechanisms to prevent a person from doing something. But let's gear this more towards treatment. I would be willing. Now, I'm not in that business. I'm in the defense business. But if I was a proponent, if I were one of those saying that we should be in treatment, I think I would get in contact with the selectmen, as they call them in Foxborough, and say, I don't like this proposal, but let's see if we can improve it, and we might support you if we can get this right. That seems like the approach I would take.
Does this, where this is, this isn't the state legislature. This is down at, you know, some little local, it's in the Norfolk County of Massachusetts. Do they have jurisdiction to make these kind of restrictions on people?
They may, in fact, very well. It would not have. Local laws usually don't carry the penalties of state and federal law. The penalties for local ordinances are usually very minor, 3 months up to maybe 6 months in the local lockup. But that's not the point. I don't think. It doesn't sound like they're wanting to lock people up. It says to intervene prior to a person breaking the law, when they're engaging in suspicious behavior that might be grooming or preparatory type of behavior. If this is not what the people who say they're for prevention are for, then I would like for them to phone in or get on the podcast and tell me what you actually have in mind when you're talking about prevention.
Right.
Because I think there's some room to develop this where it's not unconstitutional, and to actually divert these dollars that would be spent on law enforcement into prevention programs and treatment programs.
They talk about reasonable suspicion, and they say reasonable suspicion shall be defined as an incident. That would be, I think that would actually elevate to criminal conduct if there's an incident, pattern of conduct to which they're identifiable, reliable, and credible victims or witnesses. All those things sound like you've already crossed the line.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, I could hang out at a high school sporting event and talk to the student athletes till I'm blue in the face. You haven't broken any law by talking to the student athletes, even if you're 60 or 70, or even go back to the Lincoln administration.
Your age.
Right. But if you'd have to acknowledge that if I were hanging out there every day and no one knew that I was a parent of any child that was enrolled in the school system, and I was constantly talking to the adolescent athletes, at some point that would be a tad bit suspicious. Nothing unlawful about it, but it would be a tad bit. Would you be comfortable with a 60-year-old guy hanging out talking to your 15-year-old?
No, probably not.
Most people wouldn't. Okay, but it's not unlawful unless they've got posted no trespassing signs. But if it's at the ball field after school hours, usually they let people hang out and watch practice. So that would not be unlawful behavior, but it would be a tad bit suspicious.
All right.
Well, if you're in the prevention group, which we have a lot of people out there that are, if the person might be grooming towards inviting the adolescent to take a ride with them, would you rather wait until they took the ride with them, or would you want to try to get the person some counseling to find out if their intentions are towards the next step towards a sexual offense? Now, I can't answer that question because I'm not on that side. I'm not in the business of pushing prevention. But it just seems like to me that that would be something that people who are of that mindset would want to do if you're truly trying to prevent sexual offenses, if you would want to look at behavior that might be in preparation for an offense and try to intervene before the consummation of the event. That's what I would think.
Right. Just like, I don't know, how would that conversation actually go down of like, hey, Mr. Old Fogey here at the ballpark, you've been here for the last 35 practices. You're feeling a little, you know, this feels suspicious. And that would be the most awkward conversation. The person would then easily push back and say, I do what I want. This is, you know, I pay my taxes. I can be here if I want to watch. I'm going to support my team and I want to watch them practice. Also,
he very well could say that. But I hear people telling me for the last several years that there are people just yearning for help and they can't get any help until they escalate, that they're denied help. And that they, okay, well, if that's true, the conversation we'd have with them is, do you feel like there's anything that's a little bit peculiar about your behavior? Do you feel like you don't want to talk to a professional about it? Because we wouldn't want to see the situation deteriorate to you to the point to where you get in kind of trouble legally, because that kind of thing can happen when people that are of your age, if they get involved in a relationship with people the age of these athletes that you're staring at for the last 35 days. So, I mean, it would be an awkward conversation, absolutely. But prevention is always going to be awkward, I would think. If it were simple, we would be doing it a long time ago.
And the person sitting there with his camera phone out for 3 hours during practice.
So, like I said, I'm just thinking that a dialogue should happen rather than outright rejection. There are parts of this proposed policy that I would find very problematic. But I would want to dialogue about it, I would think, because these people are not loaded with money. I don't think Foxborough is a town of 16,000 usually doesn't have multi-million budget. I'm sure it's several million dollars, but they don't have hundreds of millions of dollars budget. They don't want to get in a bunch of litigation as a general rule.
Right. Right. And they do host the Patriots, by the way. So they may have a ginormous budget with
that
team.
They may very well. But I thought I had heard Foxborough when I'm hearing Patriots games. I thought that was the connection. But yeah, they may actually have all the money they need, and this may not be a problem for them. But normally a town of 16,000 is not going to want to spend gobs of money in litigation. So when you approach them and say, I want to work with you to avoid litigation, if you sound reasonable and rational, usually they'll listen.
Yeah. All right, well then let's move on and talk about some criminal justice reform statistics kind of things. Got a couple articles. I think it's just two of them that we're going to kind of squish together. One is from Valley News, and the other one is from the Baltimore Post-Examiner. And they both kind of striking down the same path of once you get out of prison, you're just screwed. You're going to earn, I think it says you will earn 75% as much. I think I remember seeing that. 75% as much as people that have not been convicted. All the barriers, you know, the checkbox on application forms, people just automatically look at you differently. So in the Baltimore Examiner, it says a 2018 study conducted by the Prison Policy Institute found that formerly incarcerated people are unemployed. Oh, I'm sorry. It wasn't paid less. It's unemployed at a rate of over 27%. We currently have, I know it's split across all kinds of different demographics, but we're sitting at around 4% right now overall, right?
Right.
So if our people or, you know, just anybody that's been incarcerated, their unemployment rate is 27%. I mean, that's a ginormous number, larger than 4%.
So that would exceed the Depression heights where we had 25% of the adult males. And in those days, they didn't count women as a part of the workforce, but 25% of the adult male population was unemployed at the depths of the Depression. So yes, it would be Depression level unemployment.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, that would be awful. It does feel, I mean, it could just be that I'm now more involved in it and I see more conversations about it, but it does feel like with the First Step Act passing, I see more stuff covered on the news that the mindset is changing. There was the article we covered maybe a month ago where the one of the Koch brothers was at a conservative conference talking about, look, we've got to get these people back into the workforce, etc. Just am I like reading tea leaves that aren't there? Is there some level of brain share change going on in the country?
I believe so. It's glacially slow, but I believe that you are seeing that. I've been saying this for a number of years now, and I tell them, even if you don't have any empathy or understanding for forgiveness, just look at it purely from selfish motivations. And most everybody can relate to that if they can't relate to anything else. We need as many people as we can possibly get working because the baby boom generation is half retired now, and they are really stressing out our systems in terms of Social Security and Medicare primarily. And we need people to replenish that workforce with as high earning capacity as they can, because we tax Social Security up to about $132,000, which leaves a lot of money untaxed for Social Security. And then we tax Medicare. It goes all the way up, but the whole amount, I think there's no cutoff point on that. But we need people earning. I don't need you earning $14,000 a year. I need you earning $70,000, $90,000, because we need all those dollars to meet our obligations. So I tell people, if you can't look at anything else, do what Lindsey Graham said when he was on Face the Nation or Meet the Press or whichever one it was, where he said, we need those people working and paying taxes. Just look at that. We need these people working and paying taxes at the highest rate they can possibly pay, because we have our paws out for the benefits. And with the deficit ballooning, we need more and more tax revenue to cover our extravagant spending that we're doing.
Don't we have, I know that I saw it in one of the two articles, and I don't remember which one it was. We have, it's okay. So it says, they call it a modern day scarlet letter, which I don't know that, I guess it is, but the one for the registry people is far worse. But there are 70 to 100 million Americans that have been touched by the criminal justice system. So like somewhere between a quarter and a third of the population is impacted directly by the criminal justice system.
That's correct. And that's
helping attitudes change. That's a gargantuan number, man.
It's helping attitudes change. People are realizing it's kind of like with the same-sex marriage and with the gays being more
right,
accepted.
Right, right, right.
More and more came out, and they said, oh, well, hey, they're in my family. Well, they're in my family, too. Well, in my family, too. And then you started hearing the vice president. Well, they're in my family, too. And first thing you knew, they didn't have cooties, and you found out that they weren't out corrupting the children and all these things that we used to think back in the 50s that they were doing. And the same thing with the criminal justice. When you realize that every third person that you encounter, which most people don't think every third person they encounter is a hooligan, when you realize that every third person you deal with has a criminal history of some sort, it makes it more understandable that people say, well, we've got to do something about that. We've got to rethink that. So it is glacially, it's slow. Legislation meets a lot of resistance that particularly from the business community. Bless their hearts, but the business community typically pushes back really hard on anything that seals records, expunges records. As a matter of fact, we're going to have a test of that here at our legislature. We passed a limited expungement bill, and it's watered down. It's the first step, and the governor is going to be faced with that pressure because the business community, they weren't able to stop it in the legislative process. And under two previous governors of both parties, Democratic and Republican governors, they were able to get the governor to veto. So we will see what this governor does with expungement. But I think that the odds are that this governor's going to sign it. She's been pretty committed and outspoken about we need to change the way we're doing business. But there will be a lot of pressure in the next 20 days applied in terms of vetoing this bill.
So people might just think that it's employment barriers, you know, just going down to the local Walmart, wherever you go to fill out an application at the local BK or, you know, some fast food joint, something like that. But we potentially limit any sort of public housing and public assistance. So that could be food stamp kind of food supplemental programs, but also all kinds of different places in different states. They will bar you from getting occupational licenses, which it is, I think sometime in our past, I think we covered an article where they were teaching you to do a trade in prison. And then when you got out, that state barred you from getting that trade.
And that's another movement that's underway around the country is to try to remove some of the licensure barriers to people that have criminal records. Because if it's really not relevant to the license, there shouldn't be a barrier just because the person has a felony. It should be directly on point to the particular license. And so that, in fact, we had some legislation. The session just ended 2 hours ago. I haven't had a chance to go through and begin to analyze how much of stuff survived and in what form, but we did have some license or barrier removal legislation and that all recognized as a problem.
It doesn't feel irrational to me if someone, you know, let's say Bernie Madoff that got convicted of, you know, embezzling, whatever, pyramid scheme for hundreds of millions of dollars. You probably don't want that guy running your cash register when he gets out. I mean, that doesn't feel icky to me, but I don't think that he should be barred from getting like a grooming license for pets or something like that.
And that's a great analogy, Andy, because he won't actually get out, but the analogy is great because you would not want him having a trading license, a broker's license on Wall Street, because clearly he couldn't keep his hands out of the cookie jar. But on the other hand, does that mean that he should never have any type of license if he were going to be released? We would like for him to start working again if he were going to get out of prison. And in his case, he's going to die in prison. But if he were going to get out, we would want him to go back to work and be productive and pay a little tax and make himself whole again. And he wouldn't be allowed to do that in so many jurisdictions because any type of license he wanted to do, if he wanted to build any type of structures, he wouldn't be able to get a license. If he wanted to tow vehicles, he couldn't get a license. If he wanted to drive a taxi, he might not be able to get a license. I mean, we go on and on. And so what could he do?
Well, I didn't realize he was 80 years old. He's 80 years old. I didn't realize he was that old. I mean, that's a spring chicken for you.
Yeah, I'm surprised he's lasted. Prison is so hard on a person of that age. I'm surprised he's lasted as many years as he has. But
even Fed? I mean, to me, Feds feels like a freaking summer camp.
Well, it takes a terrible toll when you're sleeping on concrete with no quiet to be had, and even in those so-called club Feds, the bunks are still narrow. They're still with a thin mattress. You have to play hell to try to get a medical prescription to get an extra mattress. The noise level doesn't change. Lighting, you deal with most facilities, you deal with lighting around the clock. And it takes a terrible toll on the body for a particular person of that age. And, I'm not crying crocodile tears for him. I mean, he lived a very lavish life on money of people who he took their entire life accumulation and very little of it was recovered. But I'm just saying, I'm surprised he's lasted as long as he has because prison's hard on a person that's as old as he is.
He went down right before I went away, so he's been gone for roughly 11 years. He got sentenced somewhere in 08 or 09. That's when all that stuff came crashing down. That's when I first got introduced to Inside the Walls.
Yeah, and he's 80 now.
Yeah, and that's what Wikipedia says. I know you can't trust Wikipedia. Don't tell me. Send all your hate emails over to crackpot@insaneasylum.org. That's fine.
Whose email address is that, Andy?
That's yours. Well, our next article comes from philly.com. I guess this is the Inquirer is what it says at the top of the page. But it says thousands of Pennsylvania sex offenders no longer have to register. Should lawmakers put them back on a list for life? Bum, bum, bum. One thing that I want to like really dig into is it's this, like if they pull the mat out from underneath you, so you get locked up for some sort of violation that was a registry violation, and then they turn around and they like unmake that illegal or, you know, a registry violation. Why are you still locked up? And that's in the first paragraph of this article. They talk about that. And I was like, that's really bizarre that they could de-violate you or de-violate the condition, but you could still be locked up for some period of time waiting for that to cycle through the system.
Well, the problem with that theory is that the people that are locked up are not the ones who the registry, the decision, the Sixth Circuit only applied to the plaintiffs in that case. It was an as-applied challenge. And those people are not suffering any consequences as far as imprisonment. So, I mean, your logic makes sense. But the Commonwealth is forcing another lawsuit to show that to prove that the registry is unconstitutional to everyone.
Right.
It was an as applied decision, so it was unconstitutional as applied to that group of plaintiffs and the people who were in. Like, for example, say this took effect in 2012, and say under old Megan's Law, you were going to get off in 2013. You had 3 months to go, and then you became a tier three lifetimer. Well, then you violated, and you're sitting in prison now, and you would have been off, but for the unconstitutional law. Well, you're in a real pickle because the law, you would have been gone in 2013 in the first 3 months, except for the law change in 2012 that made you a lifetimer. And then subsequently that law has been declared unconstitutional as applied to the plaintiffs in the case. And you're sitting in prison because of an unconstitutional law. The only problem is it wasn't unconstitutional as applied to you. It was only unconstitutional as applied to those individuals. And that's the Commonwealth's position that, well, we did exactly what the court told us. We provided relief to those people. So now the ACLU has brought another lawsuit that I think they've gotten certified. We probably should better check with Pennsylvania, but I think they've been certified as a class action, and that would provide relief to everybody when they eventually win that case. Well, then you got to figure out how to go back and get those people out of prison. You got to identify the people who would be entitled to relief, but right now they're not entitled to any.
And
they're serving their sentence.
I want to clarify some terms. You don't normally fudge up some words. Did you just say when they eventually win it? Do you feel that optimistic?
I don't know how they could lose it because the same legal analysis would apply with the class action that applied I said the Sixth Circuit, and please forgive me for that. I meant to say
the third, right?
State Supreme Court. And I'm thinking about the Michigan decision, so we'll scratch that. But in the Muniz decision, the state Supreme Court, which is the highest interpreter of the law in that state, they have said that it violates both the U.S. and the Pennsylvania Constitution. Well, you go back with the same set of facts with someone who had this applied to them for a defense. I mean, they're going to come up with the same result. So we're going to eventually win.
Okay.
But the Commonwealth is fighting, and like I say, well, make sure folks don't get too excited because I had Michigan on my mind.
No, I'm with you. And just remember, we're just two little knuckleheads that talk about some things. You know, you can't hold us accountable for whatever we say. That's use at your own discretion, I suppose we should say. But yeah, I mean, I get that if it's unconstitutional for one, it's not like it's, oh, well, this is a different person, so it's not unconstitutional for them. So yeah, you would just go litigate it for all the 17,000 people. But as you said, they're going to push back and they're going to fight against having this, the whole thing come down. And they've got to figure out how to put something back in place that doesn't violate the constitutionality, right?
That's correct. It looks like the Pennsylvania legislature, from this article, which was a very brief article, unless I didn't see all of it, it looks like that they are trying to come up with a very benign registry they said it would be no more punitive than renewing your driver's license. Isn't that what they said in the article?
I think so. Yeah.
They said that that they would, and there again, although registry matters, neither of the castes supports registries. You could construct a constitutional registry as long as you didn't put too many requirements in it. So I haven't actually looked at the proposal of what they're trying to get through the state legislature, but you could construct a registry that would be permissible because it's not imposing punishment on people after the fact. And we've talked about it. You could just have to mail in a form every year and come in every 3 years to have your picture updated. You have to do that to keep your license picture current usually, but like every 4 years, you have to update your photo and you have to come and see them periodically. And you have to take an eye test periodically to comply with that regulatory scheme.
Do you have fake eyes at this point? I mean, you know, eventually you like have all your teeth replaced. Do you actually have eyeballs that have been replaced?
Yes. Yes.
Let's move on.
They have done multiple multiple eye transplants. So
your head is just in a jar somewhere, isn't it? And we just hooked up some some electrodes to it to get you to speak.
Well, this article is very, very disturbing. They went back to Jerry Sandusky. He would not have to register. Well, Jerry Sandusky would never have to register because A, he's never going to get out of prison, so the registry won't apply to him. But that's the type of scare tactic they're using about why we should reenact the registry law. You know, the one that had been declared unconstitutional. We got to fix that.
Right, he came down in one fell swoop. It's not like he skirted the system a dozen times before they finally got him. I mean, it was all in one shot, and the 6 or 12 kids came out and accused him and all that. It all went down in one shot.
Yeah, but he'd been doing it for decades, though.
No, I get that. I get that part of it, but that until the investigations began, and I know that there was cover-ups and all kinds of other stuff going on. I'm not talking about that. But it's not like he dodged bullets. Kept dodging from the legal system, like the whole thing came up.
He didn't dodge any bullets. He was convicted. It was the most bizarre trial I've ever seen in my life.
Tell me why.
Well, just the craziness of. Would you?
Is this the statute of limitations thing?
Well, no. I just the stuff that was accepted behavior.
Taking showers with boys. I got.
Yeah, I have to think I'm pretty tolerant, but I have never heard of 40 and 50 year old men. Routinely taking showers with teenage boys, for God's sakes, that are not related to.
Which would go back to like the first thing we were talking about in Foxborough, like some sort of odd behavior.
So you'd have to think that when a teenage boy says, you know, I went to this special football camp at Penn State, and Coach Sandusky got in the shower with us. He did what? Coach Sandusky got in the shower with us. Let me sure I heard you right. Coach Sandusky got in the shower with you. And what else did Coach Sandusky do? Well, Mom, I hate to tell you, it's kind of embarrassing, but he kind of grossed me out. But I think he was getting stimulated by looking at me. And you would think that when that came to someone's attention, that they'd pick up the old-fashioned phone and they would call Penn State and say, do your coaches normally – I sent my kid to your camp and you charged me $1,400 for a two-week camp. Do your assistant coaches normally take showers with the teenage boys? No. How in the hell can that go on for all that time and nobody say anything about it? It'd not be unusual. I've never heard of such a thing. But Sandusky, in his defense, said, oh, well, that was normal. Really? Normal to who?
Hey, but Larry, towards the end of this article, it says, according to the Pennsylvania State Police Acting Deputy Commissioner Major Scott Price, there are 17,500 people whom he expects to be relieved of registration requirements as a result of the Muniz decision. That's everybody.
But 9 to 12,000 would be back on the registry under the draft legislation.
Right. So, I mean, you know, that effectively puts somewhere between half and all a third or two thirds of them back on.
So, well, he may not be accurate on his figures, and they may have a larger registry than we think. But the proponents of this are saying that it's not going to require much; that it's going to be a very, very benign set of requirements And like I said, I haven't looked at the registration. Pennsylvania, you're welcome to come on the podcast next week and tell us what the bill says.
And then, of course, there's a victim's advocate named Jennifer Storm. The state victim advocate said that the registration notifications are crucial to victims' peace of mind. The overwhelming majority of people on the registry should be on there. We owe it to the crime victims. We owe them some sense of safety. Do you even want to touch on that one for any length of time?
I think I'm going to try not to bash victims' advocates this week. But that's where a lot of this comes from, is it's always driven by advocacy organizations. But Dauphin, I think it's Dauphin or Dauphin County District Attorney Fran Chardo insisted the proposed law will not hit the same legal hurdles as Pennsylvania SORNA, which is the current law that was struck down. The registration obligations are less onerous than the duty to file a state income tax return.
That's pretty stellar. That sounds like, you know, we always talk about the Vermont one where you just mail in a form. That sounds something like that then.
So if it truly is that benign, you may have difficulty challenging it.
Yes.
From a constitutional perspective, if it's all that benign. But when it wants it, but see, even if it starts out that benign, this Jennifer, what was her name?
Jennifer Storm.
Yeah. She won't be happy with that. So she'll come back the following year or the year after, and she'll say, well, let's add this additional requirement. And then nobody will be there in opposition to it, and they'll add that additional requirement. And then she'll come back the next session and say, well, you know, that's working out pretty well. And first thing you know, they will stack it back the way it was, because the people who got off the registry, they're going to sail off into the sunset, and we'll never hear from them. The people who all they're having to do is mailing this relatively benign form, they're going to say, well, it's not all that bad. I better lay low, because if I make any trouble, they're going to zero in on me. And first thing you know, it'll go back to the way it was, because hiding does not solve the problem. But that's exactly what's going to happen.
And we have ample evidence for hiding doesn't solve any problems.
Yes, we've tried that. And I would wholly endorse that strategy. If laying low and trying to ride out the storm worked, I would be all for it. But it doesn't work. And that's
what happens if you cock your head a certain way.
Yes, that's my favorite one. There is people do the same thing again, and they get the same result, and then they cock their head at a different angle, and they try the same thing again. If you get off the registry altogether in Pennsylvania, don't tune this out. Don't do like you did in 2010 when they were debating this, when you were asleep at the switch. And if you get on this benign registry, and if it truly turns out to be relatively benign, don't tune this out, because they can change it at will. And each time they change it, they'll ratchet up a little bit more. And first thing you know, you'll be back to a punitive registry.
Do you want me to tell you what the Urban Dictionary says about the definition of insanity?
I think I've heard it before.
Well, for those of you that have not listened to it, and I'm going to clean it up because this is a family program. The definition of insanity is doing the exact same F thing over and over again, expecting SH to change. That is crazy.
So would that be kind of like cutting taxes and increasing spending and expecting to balance the budget?
All right. Our next article is...
We've tried that since the 1930s.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible. All right. So, New Jersey Law Journal from law.com. Bill removing time bars on sex offense civil suit gets assembly committee nod. This is coming out of Trenton, New Jersey, I guess it is. And, so here it is, where you have people that are trying, the people featured in this article, the person that they're trying to sue in this article has been dead for decades. So here you go. You've got people trying to get some sort of closure from an incident that happened 20 and 30 years ago from a guy that's been dead for decades. This all comes from the the Pennsylvania side of things, where the archdiocese up there, there was the big report, like 1,000 people alleged to have been abused by 300 something priests up in that area. And this is all, this is going to make a ginormous windfall of problems all over, not problems. The acts are allegedly happening, and I don't necessarily contest that they're happening, but it's going to be a big, massive problem for the Catholic Church over the coming years and so forth for them to defend against all these allegations.
It is indeed. It's going to be, and people forget one thing about a civil lawsuit. There's an advantage that your freedom doesn't go away. So if we have to give on the statute of limitations, I would prefer it to be on the civil side, because you're not being put in a cage. But it can destroy your entire life, even if you lose a civil judgment. And we forget the standard for a civil judgment is so much less than it is for a criminal, which is beyond reasonable doubt.
You tell me it's 50% plus one, right?
50% plus a little bit. Preponderance is a pretty low standard. And so we have, when you remove the statute of limitations for a civil action, which already has a much lower standard of proof, and you're not entitled to representation on the taxpayer dime because you're not facing loss of your liberty.
Oh, so if you don't have defense, you don't have defense.
Well, of course, now most people in reality don't sue you if you don't have bank, or if you're not connected to someone who does have bank. It's kind of futile to sue somebody who's on state assistance. But if you have a little bit, you can spend it all because you're not entitled to any relief in the way of representation, unless the entity that you work for covers you. You're on your own.
And in this particular case, these ladies are suing the church from a dead guy. So they're going to go after the church. And by every account that I've heard of, the church has got a couple bucks in the bank.
Well, and so they're bankrupted, and our archdiocese here in New Mexico filed for bankruptcy protection because they're being hit with so many of these.
Oh, really? And, I didn't know that. Yep. But I know that you now have the opportunity to rail against the statute of limitation, your problems with the statute of limitation claims.
Well, I do have the same consternation I've always had with when time passes. It's very difficult, and I ask. We were dealing with a statute of limitation bill just this session, which concluded, and we were able to contain the damage. But I asked someone to tell me where they were on a particular day in a particular year, and nobody could.
Right.
I asked them to give me a list of their friends that could vouch for them, and nobody could. And it's you know, we had a bill that started out that would have removed the criminal statute of limitations for any crime against a minor. And then through the process, it was amended several times. And we ended up with a bill that removes the statute, doesn't remove the statute of limitations. It increases the statute of limitations by 6 years from age 24 to age 30 for just the serious sex crimes against a minor. It took out the less serious sex crimes against a minor, and it took out the child abuse. And so it was a much better bill. I would rather have not had it, but we did damage control and we contained the damage by keeping it at an additional 6 years versus an eternity. But now you could have a 10-year-old, since they have to age 30, you could have a 10-year-old that could bring a 20-year-old allegation.
Right.
If they've got till age 30 to put forth their allegation.
And why do you have such a problem with bringing claims so much later in the game?
Well, the an old memory is not reliable for one thing, but the defense is so evidence that would have been favorable toward the accused tends to not be there after all those years. People die, people move away, can't be located, pieces of forensics disappear. There's just so many things that the state, as well as the defendant, and particularly the defendant, because the state's not facing loss of its freedom. But the defendant, our system is predicated upon them getting a fair trial. And it's hard to get a fair trial if all the evidence favorable to you is not available.
Right.
It's hard for me to imagine how that can be fair. And we all know that nobody lies, but we just spent the last six podcasts talking about a person who claimed he was a victim of a noose that appears to have been lying. and appears to have confessed. And I'm being careful by saying appears to, because that's what the police say. We don't have any independent confirmation. But he appears to have admitted to the police that he lied. And so we've got ample evidence with McMartin. We've got ample evidence with the Duke LaCrosse. We've got ample evidence on and on with people that make accusations that turn out not to be substantiated and to be in fact untrue. So that's the problem I have with it. We're going to put a person in behind bars for many times exceedingly long periods of time, and they can't be treated fairly before they're put behind bars. That's just not American, I don't think.
Let me ask you this question. This looks like I watch hockey, and it looks like a hockey results where here's what the team score is, and it says cleared the Assembly Judiciary Committee by a vote of 4-0-2. How do you, if there's only yes or no votes, right?
It looks like a couple of them were absent or chose not to vote. So it looks like there were four Democrats that voted for it, and it looks like the Republicans abstained. The no votes would have been the zero, and they didn't vote no, but they were absent. It says committee members voting yes, and it listed them. Then it says abstaining were two Republicans on the committee, Eric Peterson and Patrick Michael Carroll. So they decided not to vote for whatever the reasons were.
And is there any significance beside the D and the R's by their names on the way they chose to vote?
On this issue, I think you're going to get more help from the Republicans. Unfortunately, we can't be right on everything, and I feel like that my party's right more often than they're. But on this issue, they've lined up with the victims' advocates, and they think they're actually doing the right thing. And it's like in our bill here when it started as a Senate bill, and we have the majority in the Senate, and we had 8 Republicans vote no on the Senate floor, and we only had 7 Democrats vote no, and we've got 26 Democrats, and there's only 16 Republicans. Well, if we had voted no in the same ratio they did, it wouldn't have never gotten out of the Senate. But unfortunately, this one is one where the D's appear to be lining up with the victims, and I don't think that there's anything sinister. I think that they truly think that they're bringing a justice, and I think that they've got it wrong, but I believe that their heart's in the right place. I say the same thing about most of the Republicans. I think their heart's in the right place, but they're just wrong on so many things. I don't think that they're trying to destroy the nation, and I get mad when they say we're trying to destroy the nation. I don't think that they're trying to destroy the nation. I think that some of the policy choices they make are detrimental. We saw that in 2008 when we went over the cliff. But I don't think that they deliberately set about to sabotage. I mean, I don't have any evidence of that, but I think the Democrats on this particular issue believe they're right, and I believe they're wrong.
This next article comes from the Marshall Project, and it relates back to the First Step Act, which that went through, 3 months ago or so? It was, wasn't it like an 11th hour thing towards the end of the year before the elections?
Yes, okay, before the end of December. It was after the...
Okay. Right, it was lame duck session.
Lame duck, fair? Yeah.
Good. Woohoo! Got right terms. And they were seeking $75 million a year for 5 years. And then the new budget just got released, and they only had $14 million allocated. That seems, I'm not great at math, but that seems like they were a little bit short.
Well, this, this is merely the executive proposal. This is the president's budget. I give him the benefit of the doubt. The budget of the federal government, so massive, I don't think he has a clue what's in it. I think in broad generalities, he's made his position clear. He wants more for national defense, because if we don't spend more on the military, it's all been hollowed out and FATM's going to come get us. So he's made his broad policy is to spend more on military, more on internal security. And I don't think he's gotten into minutiae of this, but his executive budget will not necessarily be the final amount that ends up being for this. But it is a little bit, I mean, he did support the First Step Act, and I would hope that they would adequately fund the needs of that it takes to implement it. But
it's not like they shorted it by a few million dollars. They shorted it by like about a sixth, a fifth, well, I think is what that would be.
Well, didn't they propose like $14 or $15 million, and then you say needed $75 million?
Well, it's a supporter's worry because law seeks $75 million a year for 5 years, but president's plan lists $14 million. So, I mean, right. That's a fifth.
Yeah. They proposed, but as it works its way through the process, we can hope that what the executive proposed doesn't end up being the final amount. But like I said, I doubt he has any idea what's the budget. No president knows. Make their priorities known, what he wants in his, I'm telling you, his priority, and I'm going by his word. He wants to take care of the hollowed out military, which I don't agree that's hollowed out at all, but that's his priority, is he's pumping money into the military. And this is not something he's spending a lot of time at night saying, can we get money for this? I mean, he's passed that off to others, and apparently trying to make the numbers work. They've got real problems because the deficit is really going up. And despite all their claims, when we're in the best economy, and I keep harping on this because I'd like for our people to actually take a look at this, the deficit has exploded. We're up 77% over last year, which was up over the previous year, which was the final year of the previous presidency. The deficit for the first 4 months has already surpassed $300 billion. The last full year under the previous administration, we were only at 400 something billion for an entire 12 months. The deficit is ballooning. So, I mean, I'm sure they're looking for ways to try to contain the damage, because the revenues are just not there. The revenues shrank last fiscal year by 2%, and spending went up, I think they said either 9 or 11%. If you got shrinking revenues,
one quick favor,
and spending going up.
Explain to me the difference between debt and deficit, if you can, just so quickly for our listeners that may not know.
It's a good question, because you can play with that number. The deficit is an annual shortfall. Every year we run the budget of the United States from October 1st through September 30th. That constitutes a fiscal year. When you talk about a deficit, you're talking about what flowed in and out during that 12-month period. That's a deficit. The national debt is the accumulation of all of the existence of the United States. So every year, if you run a deficit, the national debt, of course, is going to increase, because you've got what you started with plus what you ran as a deficit for whatever period of time the president sees it. Well, under the Clinton years, we ran surpluses for 3 years. So we actually cut the national debt, and we had 3 years of surpluses. When we went into the George W. Bush years, we immediately swung to deficit because the tax cuts were going to give us the gushing revenue, and we immediately swung to deficit status, and we got up to $400 or $500 billion in deficits annually. And then the bottom fell out in 2008, and we surged over $1 trillion on an annual basis. Well, during the 8 years of the Obama administration, they brought it back $400 billion, which was too high. But it was in levels consistent with the Bush administration. But now that we have handed off the administration, at the record pace that we're accumulating a deficit right now for the first 4 months, we're going to go past $1 trillion this year, or right at $1 trillion, unless something changes in the revenue projections, which we're not seeing yet. So that's what I'm talking about, is the deficit, which is a one-year shortfall, versus the national debt, which is accumulated of all the deficits.
All right, then. Our next article is going to be about the high cost of calls in jail restricts legal access, and it does a whole lot more restrictions. This is from Law 360, and I don't think we may have covered an article from here before. But what troubles me about this, and I personally experienced it, is like the feds kicked in somewhere around in 12 or so, and they put some sort of restrictions on it. And at the time, I was paying $25 to make a phone call. Out of state, and the law kicked in like 2 months before I was released, and they came down to in the couple dollar range, and then new administration, everything went out the window. But I don't understand, you know, I work in tech all the time. I don't understand how there can be such a huge disparity between how much the states charge, where you have a state like, looks like your state is $2.04 for a 15-minute phone call, but Arkansas has $14.49.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. So what happened was that we're talking about regulatory authority, and I don't think it was as far back as 2012, but at some point in the Obama administration, he had captured control of the Federal Communications Commission with his appointments. The number of people he had appointed exceeded the number of people by the previous administration. So he was able to get an FCC regulation limiting what they could charge on interstate calls, which are those calls that, that traverse across state lines, where the FCC has regulatory authority. And that that was challenged in court, and the challengers prevailed that the FCC had overstepped their authority. But in the meantime, the new administration comes in, and they appointed some commissioners, and now they've tilted the perspective of the FCC back more in favor of laissez-faire, which is leave business alone and let them do what they need to do. And then you have a whole separate issue when you have intrastate calls, which are those calls that originate and terminate within the borders of a state. Those fall within the regulatory framework of the state regulators. And in our case, it's the State Public Regulation Commission. And we've got a bunch of damn do-gooders up there in our PRC because they're elected, and they have been very, very, very aggressive in containing that because the prisoner advocacy organizations have a sympathetic ear with our PRC commissioners. So therefore, they've contained that. From looking at the Arkansas, it doesn't sound like that their regulatory their state regulators are quite as aggressive on price containment. But then I have mixed feelings on that because, as I've said so many times, we have a conservative-leaning audience, and most of our conservative-leaning audience would probably not appreciate the big old bad government coming in and using their powerful thumb of regulations, because that's generally what conservatives say is wrong with this country, is we have too much government interference with the private sector, and they put their thumb down and say, you can't charge it. Who are you to tell these companies who have invested millions of dollars of infrastructure and setting up phone systems to keep these institutions secure, who are you, the big bad government, to limit them so that they can't return capital to their shareholders? What gives you that right?
I understand where you're coming from. However, when you are locked up and you need that support network, this is unconscionable on how this impacts people's ability to stay connected with their families out there. And anybody who maintains that position, I know you that you're not one of them. Anybody who would maintain the position that this is good policy, I would personally like to punch you right in the face.
Well, but I'm playing devil's advocate here. I don't believe that. I actually, state regulators did here, and I support what the Obama FCC did, but they were overruled by the courts. But if you're a pure capitalist, you couldn't in good conscience say, well, we appreciate you bringing all your money in here and helping us have a secure phone system, and we're going to tell you what to charge, and we're not going to let you make a reasonable return. Now, a reasonable return is all subjective to what's a reasonable return. Is it reasonable that they pay kickbacks, and they don't call them kickbacks? They call them commissions, and they have other fancy titles for the money that they give the sheriff's department that selects them to run their phone system. And to the correctional facilities, they don't call it, they call it pass through or something else. But they pass a lot of this money through. And but who are we to tell them how to do business in America? This is America, for God's sakes. And you people, you're constantly trying. You don't know how to make a payroll. You don't know how to do anything to run a business. You've never run a business. And all you want to do is to come and try to regulate people that, that have their hard-earned capital at risk. And I can't understand how you can justify that.
My challenge, though, is this isn't the Lincoln administration, where there might be technical barriers between states, but in this modern day, there is no difference between setting up a phone system in state A versus state B. So how is, like, you know, maybe there's some tax issues, maybe there's some, you know, internal regulations that you would have to work around. These people, Securus is the company that is running this stuff. These people are just straight up vultures. And to have that big of a disparity between two states, there are some states that are down in the $3, $4, $5 range, which, I mean, maybe you could call that to be like reasonable. But when you get up in the difference between $2 and $14, there's not a 7-time difference in the technology for them to make that connection go through. And it's just abhorrent. And I can't even really place anything on this map that tells me whether left leaning goes this way, right leaning goes that way. Cause you've got, whatever that would, what is that, Montana up there at 924, and then Georgia, both of those would be red states, and that's $2.59. I can't even place it that way.
Well, it's going to be more with the state regulatory body. Now, Georgia has what they call the Public Service Commission, and they elect the Public Service Commission. And the Public Service Commission, I can't speak for recently, but they used to be pretty aggressive in terms of containing prices, particularly in the area of public utilities. Now, I don't know how aggressive they've been on telephone charges as far as from correctional facilities, but the Georgia Public Service Commission has notoriously, they had commissioners like old Bobby Pafford and Ford Spinks and people from back in the 70s.
How do you know these names, man? How do you pull these names out of nowhere, man?
Because
makes
Pafford
no
was so,
sense.
He was so entertaining. I mean, you could not you could not watch Bobby give an interview and not laugh. I mean,
but I mean, so, you know, like up in New England, Rhode Island and Maine up there, it's, you know, like $2, $4 for those calls. And then Texas is $6. So, I mean, those are kind of roughly similar, but that's blue to red and it's roughly on par with each other. I don't see any sort of split between the red versus blue on to rationalize.
Well, like I say, it's probably more to do with the regulatory framework. If the regulation commission is elected, and the citizens are making their voices heard. The regulatory body, Texas has quite an interesting regulatory framework. I think they have something that's a hybrid. I think they have the Railway Commission that regulates some utilities, and I think they have another public regulatory. But it depends on how those people get to those positions. If they have to be elected, they're going to be just a tad bit more accountable. That if they don't have to be elected, so you'd have to take a closer look at the regulatory of authority of how they regulate utilities. But I pose a bigger question about what gives you the right, if you're a capitalist, to tell them what's an acceptable rate of return. Maybe in Arkansas, people don't make as many phone calls, and maybe they make more phone calls. But what's an acceptable rate of return? It's not for the big old bad government to decide what's a fair rate of return, is it?
No, I guess not. No, because we have the 50 different little test cases.
But I'm saying, but the companies will clearly do the right thing, and
of
government
course
clearly
they will.
Botches everything they touch. So it seemed like to me that we would let the companies do their thing because they'll do the right thing, right?
These guys are just vultures. JPay, all this whole prison industrial complex, these guys are
There's
assholes.
No such thing as a private company that would have sinister motivations other than doing the right thing. I am ashamed of you, Andy, and I'm going to boycott this podcast if you say that.
All right, so anybody that wants to be the guest host next week, please let me know. There's an open slot available immediately. All right, our crazy person out of Tennessee sent us in this article, and this is kind of like a think tank, I guess, kind of article talking about compelled speech doctrine should apply in challenges to sex registration laws. This is the Freedom Forum Institute. It doesn't really necessarily describe a whole lot new, but just brings up some, some historical case studies that may be useful in how we talked about it before with the Live Free or Die, where the couple in New Hampshire, they wanted to cover up. So they had some compelled speech stuff on their license plate that they wanted to cover up. And it then does feel that in many states, there is very, very, there's very egregious examples of people being forced. Oklahoma has it. I think Alabama has a marking on their driver's license, and just other things. We talk about the Halloween stuff where you got to post signs out, just miscellaneous things. Here's a whole big framework article talking about the different ways that maybe we could use these laws to use freedom of speech to push back against registration laws.
Well, I like the theory that now this article points out that the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has not been particularly sympathetic to the argument. They said the Fifth rejected such a compelled speech challenge to SORNA in United States versus Arnold in 2014, which is not that long ago. I have not read the case because I just did my prep before we started recording, so I have not read that case. But this would be a fun one to develop, maybe with someone like this, the writer of this article. It says David Hudson, Jr., visiting associate professor. Would be fun maybe to reach out to him, see if we can get him on the podcast. But I would love to explore that because I don't think it's completely nutty, but it certainly has not gained a lot of traction either. They tried that in the International Megan's Law Challenge, and it didn't gain a lot of traction with it. And that district court case in Alabama that we talked about, it gained some traction there. And we'll have to wait to see if that gets appealed to what would be the 11th Circuit. But you are being compelled, particularly if they mark your license, and if they mark it in a very obvious way, you are being compelled to speak.
Without a doubt. Let's move on over to California with the LA Times. Governor Gavin Newsom to block California death row executions, close San Quentin execution chamber. I personally am in favor of this, but it was kind of funny. As I was reading the article, I was like, doesn't this go directly against what, I mean, the people of California have decided they want to execute people. Fine, that's what they've decided. And here you go. Here's this guy. He steps into office. He's pretty new from Jerry Brown and says, nope, I'm going to shut this down. That's not what the people asked for. Wouldn't that come from the legislature? And then turns out like the next sentence said, hey, this goes against the will of the people.
It does. You notice he chose the option of a moratorium rather than a sentence commutation. I don't think he's even got the, I think that, what did it say, 700 and something people in California death row?
I believe so, yeah.
I don't think he's going to have the courage to do what we had a governor here do back in the 80s.
Yeah, 737.
We had a governor named Tony Anaya. And Tony, in his final year, and he was an attorney general prosecutor, but he was a devout Catholic and he didn't believe in executions. And he told people when he ran for governor in 82, he said, there will be no executions on my watch. And they elected him anyway. And then in his final month in office in December of 86, he was not eligible under the Constitution at that time to run for a second term. He commuted those people, and it wasn't very many. It was less than a dozen. I can't recollect the precise number, but he commuted those sentences to life in prison without parole. Now, Governor Newsom's going to have a little bit harder time when you've got 737 people, because a lot more victims' families are going to be able to descend on Sacramento if he were to do that. So he didn't go quite as bold. He's gone with a moratorium, but also he's done it in the very beginning of his administration. So being a politician, I'm wondering if he's hoping that they somehow forget about that 4 years from now when he wants to run for re-election, or that he's getting this bad news out and over with early, and hopefully they'll be on to other stories by then. I have a feeling this one won't go away in 4 years. I have a feeling it'll come back loud and clear in 4 years.
Interesting.
Answer your question, yes, it does go against the will of the people, because the will of the people, as expressed by their legislators, they have a death penalty, which has not been repealed. It's been properly imposed by the courts, however flawed the process is. And the people have not seen fit to seek repeal of that. So therefore, this would be against the will of the people of California.
And did I blank out? Did you talk about why doesn't he just commute their sentences?
Well, I think he would have such a push was involved with that many. See, like I say, in our case, it was less than a dozen. He's looking at 737.
Yeah, the population in your state's, 50, and they've got 40 million.
Well, it's all proportional. In a small state, everybody knows everybody. And it's often easier to get stuff done in a small state than it is in a large state. But I suspect that many people would form quite a lobbying effort, and they would have all the media markets would jump on board with them. And these families, I mean, they're having justice ripped out from under them by this.
Well, and commute would mean that they're wouldn't that mean they get out?
No, you can commute without letting someone out. You can, like our governor did, he commuted sentences from death to life in prison.
Okay. I'm thinking commute would be like, hey, you guys are free. Open the doors. Have a nice day.
No, that's the way that people would present it. That it's like we have a bill this year to try to clean up our parole system to people. We have life without parole, which is a relatively new penalty that came about when we repealed the death penalty back in 2009. And we previously didn't have life without parole. We had life with parole, but you had to serve 30 years. Well, we've got people that have served 30, 31, 32, 33 years, and the parole board won't release them because they say life means life. Well, no, that's not actually what it means. Life means at least 30 years and possibly released. And so this proposal was to require the parole board to at least state a reason, and that they should presumptively be released unless there's a compelling reason after 30 years to continue to confine them. That met so much resistance. The attorney general, who's a member of my party, got every victim who had anybody serving life on every TV station around the state, north and south part of the state, saying that life means life and that the Democrats are trying to turn loose murderers on the people. And he is a Democrat, but he said the liberal Democrats on people are trying to turn loose a bunch of murderers. And that legislation, I do believe, died. I haven't analyzed it, but I think it died because of all the pushback. Well, I think that there'd be a lot more than that in California with 737 families if he commuted all those sentences, because that would be seen as a slap in the face of all these people. I mean, they would forget that they're still going to be behind prison till they die. They're behind prison walls until they die. They would forget all about that. They should be going to the gas chamber, and that's what the court ordered, and that's what we should be doing as far as they're concerned. Many of them, there would be a few within that 737 who would be dead set against the death penalty. They would say, no, we should not be doing that. But people somehow or another think that the death sentence is going to give them closure. And you can talk to people like Dr. Alan Ault, who was the commissioner of corrections for Georgia and some other states, and he gave the order for a number of executions, which he has suffered in later life as a result of those orders. And he says that he has never met a victim of anyone who's been executed that has actually provided the closure that they were hoping for.
Right, right.
Because it doesn't give you the loved one back.
Nope. There's not really much you can do for that one. You can probably hold a seance and that might get it back, but I don't think so.
So we need to have Dr. Alan Ault on here. One of my favorites of all time. Can you find him? He's got to be out there.
Like out there as in like 100 years old?
Well, he would be up there in years, but I mean, he's not as old as I am.
Nobody's as old as you are.
He's a great person to talk to.
Okay. Do you think that if you get a speeding ticket that you have the right to flip off the cop without any sort of repercussions when you're done?
I wouldn't see any problem with it.
You wouldn't see any problem with it? And this is this is from The Hill?
No, I wouldn't see any legal problem. From a legal point, I can't see a problem with it. I can say from a practical point of view, there'd be a lot of problems.
I could see that the cop is much less likely to like be any level of lenient with you if you go flip him off. So there's a federal appeals court, middle finger protected by the Constitution. And this is the ruling came in response to a lawsuit from a Michigan woman who alleged she was improperly given a harsher ticket after flipping off the Detroit police officer in 2017. That's good times. But they said in a 3-0 decision that you can move this forward. I mean, there was after Trump was elected, there was a woman in D.C. and his motorcade went by, and I want to say it was just a picture of the backside of her, and it was at a pretty good distance, and she was flipping him off as he went by. They figured out who it was, and she got fired. There was all kinds of stuff. There are consequences for your freedom of speech actions.
Of course, I've never been a police officer, but if you've written someone a ticket and they're not happy about it, I would expect some. Had he actually given the ticket? I'm not clear on this. Or were they debating whether there was going to be a ticket?
The way it says from a Michigan woman who alleged she was improperly given a harsher traffic ticket after flipping off. I don't think they could, like, after you've signed the ticket, can the cop go in and change the?
That may be what the allegation is here. He may have decided, all right, well, you're going to do that. Well, let me just add the things that I could have.
Right.
That's a tough one, because if the officer says, well, I've got you for going 15 over, I've got you for failing to signal a lane change, and I've got you from drifting over, and I'm only going to give you the one for going 15 over. And then you start flipping him or her off for being nice to you. And I said, well, you know, actually, all right, I appreciate that. But I have two other offenses I was letting slide. I'll go ahead and add them. Well, I could see his or her argument on that.
Yes. fits of rudeness or lack of gratitude may violate the golden rule, one of the judges said, but that doesn't make them illegal or, for that matter, punishable or, for that matter, grounds for a seizure. So, I mean, I guess we should all get speeding tickets and then flip off the officer, and we all have cases and we can say, hey, this court of appeals said it's all right for us to do this. I'm more inclined to take the approach of being like, yes, sir, no, sir. My apologies. Just to, like, you know, if he has any or she has any sort of sense of leniency coming down the pike, that maybe they would afford it to you.
That's my theory. When I'm dealing with an officer that has unlimited backup power, they have a fair amount of regular power of their own. They've got you out armed. They've got yes. so
not
so
necessarily, much, but possibly.
they've got so much power, and they've got credibility because the officer, as far as most traffic judges, are going to believe the officer. You just are not going to win that. You're just not going to win. Why? Yes, you may be right. There are bad officers out there. Believe me, I know that they're out there. But even if you encounter a bad officer, you're not going to win that day. You're not going to win with that officer. You're not going to magically make a bad officer a good officer. And if an officer has an option, some offenses, infractions that they encounter are optional for citation or arrest. Well, I would prefer if they have the discretion to cite, I prefer a citation from my point of view. So I'm going to try to lean in the direction of trying to get the citation versus the arrest, because do you want to go downtown? I don't.
Yeah, definitely don't. Like, you thought you were going to be late. That's why you were speeding. You thought you were going to be late to your appointment, but you are certainly going to be late now if they take you downtown.
Yeah, well, say, for example, in some states, if you don't have your insurance proof, I think yours might be one of them. They can actually arrest you for failing to produce proof, or they can cite you if they think you've got it. Now, in our state, it's a citation regardless of whether you've got it. But I think in your state, they have the option of arresting. I would much prefer to be cited for not having insurance and pay the penalty for failure to have insurance than to be arrested. So I'm not going to give an officer a whole lot of grief. I'm going to be very respectful. Yeah. And
To our mantra of, like, you should comply this way, you don't get shot. Like the article with the guy cleaning up his yard last week.
Yep. And I may push back if I think they're really, really going too far. Like, I think I told you a story about the Greyhound. That wasn't an officer. That was Greyhound security. And they wanted me to open my ice chest to get on the bus. And I said, no, it's none of your business when I got there. And I eventually, after holding up the bus 5 or 10 minutes, I finally opened it, and I only had soft drinks in it. And they thought that was so nutty.
Oh.
They said, why did you hold us up? I said, because I resented you asking to see what was in my, I told you that it had soft drinks in there and you wouldn't believe me. And they, of course, their thinking was that nobody in their right mind would carry soft drinks in an ice chest. I was going to get drinking on the bus, and we're going to be in the middle of nowhere in Timbuktu. And I was going to get loud and rowdy, and they were not going to be allowed to put me off because they have their policies in terms of where they can put a passenger off. Drivers can put passengers off, but not out in the middle of nowhere. You know, they have to put them off at a town. And so they were worried that I was going to create a disturbance, and I was being obstinate. I finally let them see it. They said, what a joke. You've got Sprite and Coke and whatever I had in there.
So. Larry, you are just a rabble rouser. You are just a problem child. I could just see it all the way from the time that you were hatched, that you have just been just stirring shit all the way through.
Well, it was part of the age, and also the way that, you know, he said, open that. And I said, excuse me. He said, open that. And I said, why? He said, because I told you to. And I said, I really don't want to.
You said FYP.
I don't think I knew that in those days. But like I said, eventually I relented because the supervisor came down and said they weren't going to let me board the bus if I didn't. And then they all felt kind of ridiculous. They brought all that attention to a person carrying soft drinks on a bus.
And I guess we'll close out on this Fox2Detroit.com article that says lawsuit threatens to end the Michigan sex offender registry. So this is a two fear-mongering article night, or two article fear-mongering night, talking about the registry is going to go away, and the victims and the people just have a right to remain safe.
That was the one I had confused with the early article, because I had read this in prep.
Oh, okay. Because there's 44,000 people on the Michigan registry, which is like the second highest, I think. And then the Pennsylvania one has 17 and change on there. I don't want to like try and beat a dead horse, but it's similar arguments. But here we go. We have another case up there in the north. That's, we also have the Michigan district attorney saying that the registry is just something really horrid and shouldn't really do much with it.
Well, that would be the Michigan Attorney General who said that. But see, the people, I keep going back to the people. Until we convince the people that the registry is a waste of their money and doesn't do anything, the people are going to keep demanding it. If you can pick any location you want to take a poll, I don't care if it's in the liberal New England or whether it's in the conservative Texas, the people support the registry.
Right.
And I'm saying the people, not 100%, because someone's going to write in and say, Larry, you don't understand. I've met 7 people in the last 3 years that oppose the registry or whatever the number is. And I understand that you have met 7 or 12 or whatever. But if you take a random select of 100 people, you wouldn't have an extreme variation if you were in Texas or if you were in Massachusetts. If you ask the same question, do you believe the sex offender registry enhances public safety? I will promise you that the majority, overwhelming majority, will say yes. And if you turn around and flip it over and say, do you think we should abolish the sex offender registry? I don't care if you ask in Texas or if you ask in liberal Massachusetts. The overwhelming majority are going to say no. And as long as that's where the people are, that's where the population, that's where the population is. That's where the elected officials that represent the population, that's where they're going to be.
There is a couple clips in there. And so there's a mom. Literally, it's listed like her credentials are Kate Churchill, a mom, says that being the parent of a teenage daughter, it's a good tool to use appropriately. Again, what does it tell you other than that there's a person that was committed that has committed a crime sometime in the past that lives nearby? It doesn't likely give you a whole lot of detail of the circumstances or anything, or it might not even tell them when it happened. It just says that they did it. And there's another clip from an attorney, Jessica Wall, and the punishment should fit the crime, and I think our state is doing just that. Good times.
The only problem is, see, that's a person who doesn't realize that the registry is an odd part of the punishment. The average person does think that the registry is a part of the sentence, and it's a part of what's extracted in the punishment. And when you ask people, when you say, now, you have to frame it up this way. You have to say, do you believe that a person, after they've paid their punishment, should continue to be punished? And the overwhelming majority will say, well, of course not. What, do you think I'm some kind of nut? And then you say, well, do you believe that a person who's paid their debt to society in full should continue to have to report to a police station to be fingerprinted, booked, and have restrictions imposed on them? And then most of, again, will say no. And then you say, well, do you realize in the registry of sex offenders, after they've paid all their debt, they did their 10 years in prison, they did 20 more years reporting in to the registry, and it just never ends, because then they changed the law and said they have to report in for the rest of their life. And plus, they changed it from once a year for 20 years to 4 times a year. Do you think that's okay? You actually can gain a little bit of traction with that, because you say, well, wait a minute, I thought you told me just early in this interview that you said that after they pay their punishment, their prison and their post-prison supervision, after you told me that you thought after that was over, they shouldn't be punished anymore. Now you've just done a flip on me. You're telling me that you think it's okay for them to be restricted in terms of where they can live and work and be, and they have to continue reporting to the. Sometimes you can get them to in a contorted position, but the people support the registry.
Yes, I completely agree with your point there.
So what do you do in a representative republic? Do you flip the middle finger to people and say, well, I'm sorry, did you report it, but you're wrong?
Well, as you have stated on multiple occasions, just because we have a this kind of republic, we can make bad policies and they are assumed to be constitutional. We have a pretty ill-informed public, generally speaking.
And a bad policy doesn't make an unconstitutional one. And right. that's what confuses folks. A law can be bad, but it doesn't make it unconstitutional. It just makes it unwise. You have a whole different threshold to prove something is unconstitutional. But merely being bad, it's okay for us to impose bad things on ourselves.
Well, before we close this thing out, I wanted to take a minute to thank our top patrons. These are the people that have supported us the mostest over the last year or so. Year and a half.
How do you spell mostest, so I can get that in my
mostest would be MOST and then just EST. It's just mostest.
Mostest. Okay. All right.
And we got Michael A, we got Patty, Hank, Suzanne, and Gerald.
And we've got Dave, our longest patron of all in terms of time.
Yep.
Horace, Michael H, and Justin. And our top patron is who, Andy?
Our top patron is Thomas. And try to beat him if you can. would totally appreciate, you know, find that paycheck stub and just start filling out all the zeros. That would be awesome. But so very much thank you to all of the people, all of our listeners, and all of our patrons. We love you guys very much.
Didn't you have a formula for what the people do with their paycheck that you recommended?
Just transfer the number, really. I mean, just take the number that's there, you know, where it says amount deposited, and just fill it out on the Patreon form.
Okay, is it the gross or the net that you
yes. I'm not going to really split hairs over it. Whichever one you feel more comfortable with.
But joking aside, it would be so kind if it were a dollar. We're trying to build a number of patrons. There's an impressive of having more supporters. So the dollar, if it's in your budget, we want to be at 100 supporters by the end of the year.
That would be amazing.
And I hate to have to create 70 or 60, however many we are short of
you got a green dot them?
Yeah, and I don't know how to do that. I'd have to create like 60 email addresses for the dollar, and then I had to figure out how to generate a dollar payment from some payment source to make that work. But we want to try to boost our number of supporters up to 100 by the year end.
And so then how can other ways for people to support, share the podcast with all the people? If you're in treatment class, you could share it. If you, just randomly, if you want to, you know, tell people about that, it'd be awesome too. But find us over at Registry Matters, registrymatters.co, and Larry loves phone calls. So leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. If you want to shoot us an email message, you can do it at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And of course, then Patreon is patreon.com/registrymatters. Come hang out on the Discord server. If you want to find a link, you can get that at the website. And I think that's all I got.
Well, thank you, Andy, for having me back this week. It's always a surprise to be invited back.
And for those of you who want to take Larry's spot, you can send applications. If you want to send those into registrymatterscast@gmail.com, I will be taking resumes for a replacement. And I'm just kidding. I don't think we could replace you.
And after my pontification about the business interfering with business, we'll probably have enough hate mail that I've probably stepped in it big this week, don't you think?
It's very possible, but so far, nobody's really challenged you, Larry.
So, well, and I'm only trying to provoke thought, because when people say, I believe that business has to be regulated, most people do. The question is, how do we define where we regulate, what the standards are, and how aggressively we regulate, and who makes those decisions, and how are, there's so many components of regulation. I don't think anybody would say we should never regulate, but that's the argument. That's a blanket argument. Well, it's just too much regulation. Okay, well, here's an example where the government started regulating a little too much, and there was too much pushback. So we got to find that right amount of regulation.
Absolutely. Well, cool, Larry. I'm out. I hope you have a wonderful Saturday night, and your legislative session is over. So you're going to go on vacation.
And unless we have a special session, which there doesn't appear to be for at the moment.
Excellent. I will talk to you soon, my friend.
Good night.
Bye.
You've been listening to FYP.